They've got their health care reform bill now in the Senate, but Democrat Jay Rockefeller is having regrets about the public option, the name at least.
A lot of it is the word public. Option is a good word. I wish we'd thought of that a year ago.
Well, could a name change help? Let's ask Rodney Dangerfield.
I said, I don't understand. I mean, is it good to change your name? He said, of course, I always keep changing my name. In fact, right now, I can give you a very good deal. I have a new name coming in next week, and I need the space.
The Whatchamajigger. The Whatchamajigger. Yeah. Who can be against that?
Thingamajigs, Whatchamajiggers, and Dangerfields, a huge milestone for healthcare reform. We're taking names on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning, everyone. It's Monday, November 23rd. I'm John Hockenberry, flying solo a little bit. Celeste Headlee is out today. But also on the program, when bad mortgages become good business, two perfect seasons and one huge upset in the NFL, and disclosing you are bankrupt, announcing you are headed for jail, not the father of your kids, etc. You've always hated your mother. Things we don't recommend you bring up at the Thanksgiving dinner table. Some advice in a moment. But first, Takeaway DC correspondent Todd Zwillick joins us. Todd, good morning.
Good morning, John.
So it sounds like they're pretty nervous about the name Public Option down there in the Senate. Is a name change going to help anything?
Well, Jay Rockefeller's a little bit nervous about the name. He's a strong proponent of the Public Option. It's going to take a lot more than a name change, John, because you've got at least four moderate to conservative Democrats who say they aren't voting for the Public Option,
right,
either in name or in function, until it changes a lot or goes away completely to get this thing off the floor.
I mean, based on what happened over the weekend, how durable do you think this 60-vote majority is?
Well, right now it's not durable at all, because it's not a question of Republicans peeling these conservative Democrats away. It's a question of Harry Reid finding a way to get them back on. You know, they got this bill on the floor for him, but now they have all said they need a lot of work to get this bill to a point where they will vote for it again on public option,
right,
abortion, and cost. So it's really a question of getting them on there. And Ben Nelson said it's more than a question of nuance. It's fundamental change.
Well, Todd, thanks. We're going to talk about the fundamental change issues in cost savings in just a minute in healthcare reform, but now everything else you need to know this morning. And as we've been talking to Todd, Democrats are saying this morning they will push through the healthcare bill with or without Republican support. One of the most contentious points remains the so-called public option, which Senator Dianne Feinstein told Meet the Press yesterday is necessary to keep the insurance companies in check.
This is the reason for the public option, to put out there some competition that will sober this huge for-profit 800-pound gorilla.
Some Republicans weren't buying it, though.
It's the same turkey you didn't like in August, and it's not going to taste any better on Thanksgiving.
That's Senator Lamar Alexander, Republican of Tennessee. The floor debate begins next week. Professed 9/11 mastermind Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and four of his accused accomplices plan to tell a courtroom only blocks away from the World Trade Center site what they did and why they did it. Their lawyer says the accused terrorists will plead not guilty and use their civilian trial to air their criticisms of the United States. Deadly weekend for U.S. soldiers in Afghanistan. The military says four service members have been killed in the past 24 hours. And federal investigators at the Three Mile Island nuclear power plant in Pennsylvania this morning say after a small amount of radiation was detected over the weekend, they're looking into safety. But spokeswoman Beth Archer says
no contamination was found outside of the containment building. There was no threat to public health and safety.
Minor problem up in space this morning. Astronaut Robert Satcher was just about to take the third and final spacewalk when a valve on his suit came off. The crew reattached the valve, and to everyone's relief, it stuck right back on. So, markets this morning. The Dow opens a tick above 10,300. Futures are up. The S&P will open a shade under 1,100, and NASDAQ opens at 2,146. So, there are very tough decisions involved in healthcare. Some people call it rationing, and it's a big, passionate issue in healthcare reform debate in the U.S. Senate. But what's your story? Everyone makes tough choices in healthcare. How have you decided treatments to avoid or to adopt based on cost or appropriateness? 877-8MYTAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Good morning, everyone. John Hockenberry here. Celeste Headlee is taking a sniffly flu season day off this morning. We'll see her tomorrow. Sunday gave us all a 60-vote majority in the Senate. The procedural vote on the health care reform bill It passed. The filibuster-proof majority that the Democrats have in the Senate is solid for now, but for how long? The real hard debating begins on the floor of the U.S. Senate starting next week, and front and center will be this issue.
Every other major industrialized nation but the United States has a budget for how much taxpayer funds are allocated to health care, because they've all recognized that you could bankrupt your country without it.
So you're talking about rationing.
Listen, we ration now. We just don't ration rationally.
That's David Walker, former head of the Government Accountability Office, speaking with Steve Croft on 60 Minutes last night in a story that's all about the distorted allocations of taxpayer money in health care as we currently do health care in the United States. Could that change? All agree that whatever version of the health care reform bill that emerges from the Congress, possibly by the end of the year, won't have succeeded unless it contains mechanisms to reduce somehow spiraling health care costs. At the very least, reform has to include a new way for patients and doctors to discuss healthcare options and to evaluate their care. And we saw just as recently as last week how difficult this is. New recommendations on breast cancer and cervical cancer screenings that could produce exactly a cost-saving result produced all kinds of anxiety and concern among doctors, among patients. How difficult is this all going to be? Well, joining us now is Arthur Kaplan, director of the Center for Bioethics at the University of Pennsylvania. Good morning, Art.
Hey, John. How are you?
And Dr. Stacy Berg, pediatric oncologist at Texas Children's Hospital, also joins us. Doctor, good morning.
Good morning.
Well, first of all, Arthur, generally speaking, we don't have much of a tradition in the United States of having serious discussions, doctor-patient or hospital to community or government to taxpayers, as to how we allocate funds for health care, correct?
I think that's true. I think we have a tradition of burying the cost of things. When your employer supplies insurance to you, you don't see very much in the way of what it's costing really to buy your insurance, if you will. When it's a bedside, it's fair to say that people have no idea how to read a hospital bill. They don't want to look at them. We try as hard as we can to disguise the fact that healthcare costs us money.
So we saw last week with the new recommendations on screenings for mammograms and pap smears that people feel good when they're tested. People feel good getting tested more, even if it's not scientifically recommended. Do you think this tension between science and a kind of feel-good sense of being checked out is also at work in the healthcare debate in Congress?
I do. I think that America has a culture of more is better. And in the face of disease, doing something is better than doing nothing. And that extends, obviously, into the realm of prevention. So we like to feel that there are things we can do to take charge of cancer and be on top of preventing it and controlling what's going on. And it even appeals to our sense of personal responsibility. Very important that we feel like we're doing the right thing in healthcare. We've been told to take charge and try to do what's necessary to control our health. So these are all things that don't square up when the data says, you know, screening under 50 for breast cancer, that just may not be the best way to spend money.
All right. Arthur Kaplan is director of the Center for Bioethics at the University of Pennsylvania. Dr. Stacy Berg, in many ways, changing our frequency of pap screenings and breast cancer mammograms in many ways is the low-hanging fruit. It's the easy cost savings. What are the harder kind of single, maybe end of life or difficult, maybe oncological questions that you deal with every day?
Well, one of the things I'd like to say is that I'm not sure that the point behind changing the recommendations for screening for breast cancer with mammograms, for example, is about cost savings. It's about the risks and benefits. And although cost may also be a part of the conversation whenever we talk about the appropriate way to apply a test, I think in this particular case, cost was not a major part of the conversation. The real conversation was for patients or for women who are getting mammograms, do getting mammograms when you're under 50 give you benefits compared with the things that happen that are risky or that are undesirable outcomes?
You know, you make a really important point. Let's focus on that nuance for a second. I think a lot of Americans, when they hear people making this cost-benefit analysis, this scientific inquiry into whether this test is worthwhile, they hear something different going on. They hear it's too expensive. The rich people are going to get this test, but I'm not. How do we change that?
Well, I think we did hear that, certainly on television in the days after the recommendations were released, and we heard it in the newspaper, and I think we heard it from some of our advocacy groups and our colleagues. I think the way we need to change it is, first of all, as Art mentioned, by having a rational dialogue become part of our psyche when it comes to health care. Everyone knows that it costs money. No one knows how much it costs, and no one knows really how much it costs me as an individual. It's very hard to understand that about your own health care. And when it comes to difficult things like figuring out exactly how much benefit there is of a screening procedure or how much benefit there is of a surgical procedure or, say, of a new anti-cancer drug, I think that we have to start with an honest dialogue and a willingness to try to understand some of the difficult concepts of statistics and odds, and then we can try to figure out how do those apply to me as a doctor speaking to a patient? How do those apply to me as a woman trying to decide whether to get a mammogram when I turn 40? These sorts of things.
But Dr. Berg, you know, and I don't want to push you necessarily in this direction, but as a pediatric oncologist, these kinds of discussions couldn't be more difficult, I would think.
No, these kinds of discussions are always very difficult, and we relatively seldom make any decisions in pediatric oncology based on cost, but we talk all the time about what are the risks to your child, what are the benefits to your child. And one of the reasons that these conversations are so difficult is that if we knew exactly what would happen to any individual, then we would be able to say very clearly, here's what you should do. The difficulty is when we look at a broad population and we say, all right, for 2,000 people, here's what will happen to most of them, and then try to make a decision for one person based on that.
Oh, that's a perfect, you know, a probability is a probability, but one life is one life, that's
exactly.
For sure. Dr. Stacy Berg, pediatric oncologist at Texas Children's Hospital. Very quickly, Art Kaplan, do you see anything in this health care bill that will help Americans get into these kinds of discussions in a responsible way?
Ironically, I do, because I think if we're all in the same boat, if we extend coverage out to everyone, then we all have a stake in trying to figure out, well, really, what is this going to cost us as we begin, in a sense, to have to work on this together?
There's
keeping the quarter of the population out is rationing in the worst way.
Well, getting everyone in the same boat. Arthur Kaplan, director of the Center for Bioethics at the University of Pennsylvania. There's a takeaway. Thinking about health care reform passed in the Senate. Where does it go from here? Thanks to you both. And now, at 15 minutes past the hour, let's get a look at the top headlines from our very own Femi Okay. Good morning, Femi.
Good morning, everybody. Hello there, John. Senator Charles Schumer says that majority Democrats will push through a bill overhauling the health care system with or without Republican support. Schumer appeared on NBC's Today Show this morning in the wake of a key Senate vote Saturday that paved the way for debate on the measure. The military says that four U.S. service members have been killed in the past 24 hours in Afghanistan. Three were killed in the south. In the Philippines, 21 people have been abducted and killed by gunmen. The deaths are thought to be linked to a regional election there next year. First-time buyers rushing to beat the clock on what they thought was an expiring tax credit are expecting to have pushed up October home sales. Economists polled by Thomson Reuters say that they expect last month's sales to show a 1.4% increase. The tax credit has been extended to the spring. And those are some of the headlines we're following this morning.
So coming up, bad mortgages become good business. Everybody wins except the federal government. We'll ask Louise Story about that in just a few minutes.
Hey, you want that to go?
Sure you do. Takeouts this morning. And Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen is here in the studio along with the business reporter for the New York Times, Louise Story. Good morning to both of you.
Morning.
Good morning.
Our first takeout, though, is a shout-out to all of you. We're talking about the health care legislation that passed on a procedural vote in the Senate. It's a first step, of course, but it's a landmark piece of legislation. We want to look at it from all angles this morning. But we're particularly interested in talking with you about rationing. Have you ever made a health care decision based on cost or based on some sort of assessment of the scientific efficacy of that procedure? Did you opt out of extra coverage? Have you rationed your own care? Tell us your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE. We're looking for some responses from you. But our first takeout goes to Louise Story, and New York Times business reporter. And, you know, you're kind of a detective this morning. I don't know if any of you missed this front page story that Louise had on the cover of the Times yesterday. You know, I've always thought to myself, in this financial crisis, there were all these toxic assets, bad mortgages that exist on the books, and somehow they're getting traded away. Somehow they're getting getting resurrected. And you found exactly a story of this
happening.
I did.
I went on a hunt. There were a ton of bad assets sold and still being sold by a lot of banks who have been under pressure to purge themselves. And they've sold them for pennies on the dollar. So, you know, Citigroup, for instance, has traded big blocks of millions of dollars of mortgage loans, but they've sold them at a huge discount. So maybe, you know, a hedge fund out there paid only 40 cents on the dollar to buy this big group of mortgages.
And these mortgages didn't go away. They're essentially lists of addresses of
people
who are, some of whom are still paying, some of aren't, some of whom are close to default.
A lot of whom are still living in their homes.
Right.
And I found this family in Southern California, Mary Sella and Stephen Alva. He's a 62-year-old janitor, father of three. She stays at home. They bought their house 2 years ago. They were a little stretched to do it, but they were pinching pennies to pay off this house. And out of nowhere last December, they got a letter in the mail, and it said, just call us. We bought your loan at a discount from Chase, and we want to share that discount with you. Can you imagine getting this letter?
And they said, they're paying some interest rate that's high and some payment that's huge, and they're underwater on their house, right?
Their house is way underwater.
Okay. And suddenly they get a call from a hedge fund saying, hey, we bought this for nothing.
And we'll share the discount with you, the
Which
hedge fund says.
Lowering the payment and everything?
So what? So they thought it was a scam at first. I mean, wouldn't you?
Sure.
And so they called in and they finally found out that it was true. And this hedge fund out there reduced the principal balance on their loan, the amount they owned, by $126,000.
Wow.
So this was a $440,000 loan. Now it's much lower. And so they were very happy, of course. The two things that are interesting here is, to this day, they don't know who this hedge fund was. Huh. It worked through all these intermediaries and kept its identity hidden from them. Okay. And second thing that's interesting is, there was a catch on them. The hedge fund didn't just give them the money. The hedge fund said, but we need you to refinance it into a government-backed loan. And when they refinanced into an FHA loan, which is the Federal Housing Administration, that agency that now we're all worried about, they refinanced into an FHA loan. The moment they did that, the hedge fund was able to sell that loan into another government agency, Ginnie Mae, which bundles it up and sells it to investors. So then the hedge fund got out. They cashed out.
So they buy them at fire sale prices
yes.
from banks that probably the taxpayers own already,
right.
in the case of Citibank.
Right.
They share the discount with
the homeowner to convince them
to refinance and get a federally backed loan, which then they can unload for a much higher price.
Right. Now the risk is on the taxpayers.
Is this illegal?
No. And in fact, you know, policymakers in Washington are really encouraging people to refinance into government backed loans. And I talked to the FHA and I talked to the Treasury Department. I asked them if they were concerned. They said they have no signs of abuse, but they realize that there could be bad incentives here. So they're watching it.
Oh, it's really interesting. Louise Story, our partner, the New York Times finance correspondent on the case of what happens to bad loans when they become good business. Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, we've got two perfect seasons working here and one incredible upset in the NFL weekend over the weekend.
Well, talking about that perfect season with the Indianapolis Colts, they dodged a bullet. They beat the Baltimore Ravens 15-17.
Awful game.
And they had three turnovers, which normally when you're talking about multiple turnovers in a game, you're talking about a loss.
And listen to this.
Gee, many Christmas. I've never seen such mess as we've had this afternoon. But the Colts apparently are going to get out with their 10th straight win, 19th overall. That's the ball game.
17-15 score. It's got to be a mess with that kind of a
and
score.
And they've won 19 games in a row, which means that they have the second best win streak in the NFL history.
And the New Orleans Saints, still for real, a blowout of the Tampa Bay Buccaneers.
They did what they were supposed to do. If they had been close, you would have been wondering how many more bullets were they going to dodge, but they came out with all cylinders firing.
And Kansas City beats Pittsburgh, excuse me?
And that's the upset of the year so far. You have a Matt Castle, who was a quarterback who played for the New England Patriots last year when Tom Brady went down. He comes over, he has his own team. They've had some struggles this year, but he came through when it really mattered. And it mattered against the former Super Bowl champions. So that puts all the AFC AFC North teams lost yesterday. And that changes the playoff picture a little bit in the AFC.
Well, let's talk about that.
So basically you have Denver, who's been on a four-game losing streak. So now the San Diego Chargers have bumped into number one in that slot. So now you have a different kind of picture. You have about three or four teams tied for the wild card race, which includes Jacksonville.
Right.
And includes Pittsburgh. Because Cincinnati and Indianapolis, they're really wrapping up their divisions.
And New England put a boot print on the New York Jets, so they're still in it. They're at the top of their
Correct.
Division.
You can almost assume that New England and Indianapolis are going to be meeting at the end.
San Diego's at the top of its division
Correct.
In the west of the AFC. But what about the NFC?
The NFC is looking somewhat similar, except that you have the two top teams, obviously the Minnesota Vikings
Right.
and the New Orleans Saints. After that, you have a bunch of other teams, the Cowboys, the Giants, the Eagles. You have a lot of teams that are in the same position, have the same record, and right now it's a toss-up to see who's going to take those other spots.
Somebody asked me to ask you this. Is the Jets season over?
Well, the Jets season, yes. I would say the Jets season, it's not over. They have to play a bunch of more games, but are they going to make the playoffs? No.
Oh, they still have to actually play the games.
It's true,
right?
Exactly.
Yeah. Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen with our sports takeout. Thanks so much.
Hey, good morning.
Coming up, the week ahead is our focus on the agenda segment, which we do every Monday morning. More on that in just a few moments. But right now, let's check in on some top news stories at 30 minutes past the hour with Femi Okay.
Hello there. Democrats are saying this morning that they will push through the health care bill with or without Republican support, despite a few moderate Democrats already saying that they will scuttle the bill if the public option stays in. Senator Jack Reed says,
despite all of the ups and downs in this process, despite all of the fabrications and fears being spread, we have a darn good bill here.
Now, Republicans remain united in their opposition, with Senator Richard Burr mocking the bill.
This is the Harry Reid layaway plan for this holiday season. Pay in for 4 years, and in 4 years, you'll find out exactly how expensive this plan was.
The floor debate begins next week. It has been a deadly 24 hours for U.S. soldiers in Afghanistan. NATO is reporting that three American servicemen were killed in bombings, while a fourth died in a firefight. A lawyer for one of the five men facing trial in the September 11th attack says that all five will plead not guilty and use their civilian court trial to air their criticisms of the United States. Justice Department spokesman Dean Boyd says that they won't be successful in their propaganda efforts.
We believe that they will have no more of a platform than what they've already had, and certainly we're not afraid of some rants by some of the defendants.
Last week, Attorney General Eric Holder said he did not believe holding the trial in New York will increase the risk of terror attacks there. A survey of economists suggests that the job market may finally start loosening up next year. The National Association for Business Economics expects employers to start hiring more in the second quarter of 2010. Until then, they expect consumers to keep a pretty tight rein on their budgets. Some more good news in this tough economy. A survey finds that the average price of regular gas nationwide has dropped almost 4 cents a gallon over the past 2 weeks. Trilby Lundberg runs the survey.
The entire gasoline market is in glut because demand is hampered. There's so much gasoline because there are so many fewer employed motorists.
And one employed motorist is Jimmy Johnson, who sped into NASCAR history by winning a record fourth straight Cup Series championship. He clinched the title with a fifth-place finish at the Homestead Miami Speedway, and it went into the record books, according
He's
to Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen.
Some motorist. Guy. He's some motorist, Jimmy Johnson is. Thank you, Femi.
You're very welcome.
Our government.
Iran.
Your government.
Proliferation.
Public option.
A serious insurgency.
We do have a plan. We're working on
Just
it.
Just to give you a sense of perspective. Oh,
Well, certainly some of those stories are going to have traction all week long. And on Monday, that means it's time to check out what else is on the agenda for this week. We were joined earlier this morning by Marcus Mabry, international business editor for our partner, the New York Times. And we also spoke with Nasis Avros, the executive editor for the Asia-Pacific region for our partners, the BBC. And we began by asking you about the impact of the Mumbai attacks that took place 1 year ago on Thursday, Thanksgiving Day. There were two arrests in Pakistan over the weekend. We asked Nasis Avros if he thinks this will continue to be an unhealable wound between India and Pakistan.
I don't know if it is going to be unhealable, but definitely this is a very, very difficult moment. India and Pakistan, they had been talking for several years, but after the attacks in Mumbai, India and Pakistan's the peace dialogue, which is called the composite dialogue, that came to a standstill. And for nearly a year now, 26th of November is going to be the first anniversary of the attack. For a year now, they have not spoken. Yes, they have met on the sidelines of several international meetings, but the composite dialogue between the two countries, it definitely has not taken place. So that gives you an indication how sensitive this issue is, because India goes on saying that the perpetrators who came from Pakistani soil, Pakistan will have to do something about them. And the main group that has been, that India said was behind these attacks, Lashkar-e-Taiba, their chief, he was arrested first by Pakistani authorities, then he was released by a court. And so what India says, that what is your intention? You have to show your intention that you are going to take action against these people. Pakistan, on the other hand, says that you have not given us enough evidence. You have to give us evidence so that we could try them in our courts.
And indeed,
and this is where it stands.
The tensions there continue. And of course, Indian Prime Minister Manmohan Singh is coming to Washington. He'll actually be at the very first official state visit Barack Obama is having at the White House. What do you think on their agenda, besides these attacks and the problems that India continues to have with Pakistan, that might have an impact on the president formulating his new strategy for Afghanistan?
I mean, they're going to talk about a whole host of things. Among them, from India side, of course, Pakistan and Afghanistan is going to be very important. Right now, with like any other U.S. administration, for Obama administration as well, Pakistan will remain a very important country, a very important friend or partner or ally to stabilize Afghanistan. U.S. administration will have to have that support from Pakistan, Pakistani army, so that they can fight the Taliban and the Al-Qaeda elements who are harboring inside Pakistan in the lawless tribal areas. Now, India has got its own agenda.
Sure.
India would like to tell America that you take a tough stand against Pakistan. You tell them to dismantle all what India calls terrorism infrastructure inside Pakistan. Also, India has a deep strategic interest in Afghanistan. India is one of the biggest rebuilders of Afghanistan since the war and the fall of Taliban. In last 7 or 8 years, India has put in more than $1 billion in the rebuilding of Afghanistan.
And certainly plenty of what the president and Manmohan Singh will be talking about does relate to business. Marcus Mabry, how important is this economic relationship, and how close are we to a new Afghanistan strategy from the White House, do you think?
Well, the economic relationship between the U.S. and India is very important. Lots of time, Indians feel like they have been given short shrift internationally on economic issues, and that China, their neighbor and their competitor, wins all the accolades. So the U.S. is actually the country that gives India a sense of its self-esteem and its respect actually being validated by the world. So this is incredibly important for India, I think, that the Prime Minister Singh is actually the first official state visit to the White House of the Obama administration. So that's very important. And it's to underline that important relationship that the administration has done that. On Afghanistan, as far as policy, we could have a policy as soon as this week. We could have, an address right after Thanksgiving or even on Thanksgiving, or I think next week at the latest is when we'll actually have the policy rolled out. And it will likely not be as many troops as General McChrystal asked for as far as his top number, but it will certainly be additional troops going in.
And, of course, the Senate stayed up late. They worked the weekend, and the 60-vote majority seemed to survive a procedural vote. There is a health care reform debate that will begin next week in the Senate. Where does that stand as far as the White House is concerned, Marcus Mabry?
Well, the White House is very happy about this, but the problem for the White House is they barely got across the finish line just for a procedural vote. That's actually a very bad sign. When it actually comes to voting for the bill in its current form, we have lots of conservative Democrats and Senator Lieberman from Connecticut saying they would not vote, actually, although they voted for the procedural measure. They would come to the the floor for debate, they would not vote for this bill. The danger is, remember last time when they all went home, the Congress went home, and they heard all those people, those angry cries in August. The danger is they're going home again for Thanksgiving. So that's what we have to watch for this week.
All right, so Barack Obama looked pretty exhausted when he got back from Asia at the end of the week, but Sarah Palin on her book tour is positively effusive. A quick thought on the Palin mania that seems to be out there?
This is her week. This is made for her. Thanksgiving is Sarah Palin's holiday. It's our least intellectual, most emotive.
Marcus Mabry, international business editor for our partner, the New York Times, and Nasis Avros, BBC executive editor for the Asia-Pacific region. They joined us for The Agenda earlier this morning. Coming up, we talk about families every Monday. How can you have a peaceful Thanksgiving when your relatives might make it tough, either before dinner, during dinner, or that all-important after-dinner discussion? Family tensions later this hour. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. And joining us this morning from Georgia Public Broadcasting in Atlanta, Georgia, is Ricky Bevington, a TV and radio news anchor for Georgia Public Broadcasting. Good morning, Ricky.
Good morning, John.
So there was a debate last night between the two candidates left in the Atlanta mayoral runoff campaign, and it was historic in the sense that there's a possibility that Atlanta could have the first white mayor for the first time in 35 years. But I'm wondering if the tone of this debate suggests that Atlanta is a truly post-racial city in the sense that the race has become a secondary issue in Atlanta all of a sudden.
Well, you know, people that I have spoken to are very aware that getting a white mayor would be a big change. But I have to say, John, they're not that inspired by either of these two candidates. So, yes, it's historic that a white person could win. But voter turnout on December 1st is only expected to be maybe 15 to 20%. So a lot of people on December 2nd are going to be saying, who's mayor? But only 15 to 20% of them are going to actually be coming out to vote.
How has this race changed the traditional power structure in Atlanta? Which candidate has received which endorsements, and what are the surprises there?
There's really no surprises. Mary Norwood, the white city councilwoman, is an independent. She is liberal, but she's not beholden to the Democratic Party in the state. She does have the backing of a local gay group and one lone African-American state senator. However, Kasim Reed has the backing of the city's Democratic political machine. It dates back to the Mayor Jackson administration of the 1970s. Democrats are backing Reed because in the upcoming elections, the Democrats cannot afford to lose Atlanta. This is Georgia's Democratic base. So in terms of the power structure, yes, if Mary Norwood, an independent, were to win, it would greatly reduce the power structure of the Democratic political machine in Georgia.
In Chicago, where I have a fair amount of experience, the independent candidates running against the machine were always very racially charged races. Not the case in Atlanta, though.
Not the case in Atlanta. In fact, last night during the debate, one of the panelists asked Mary Norwood. She has been saying that some of her black campaign workers have been harassed, street signs have been stolen, and she said that she would give Kasim Reed the benefit of the doubt that that was not under his watch. And he said that he would give her the benefit of the doubt that his white campaign supporters being harassed was not something that she knew about. However, Reed said something interesting. He said simply that he believed that this is a charged race. Emotions are going high, and by race I mean election.
Gotcha.
Emotions are running high, but not because of race, but simply because people feel so passionately about their candidate.
And it seems as though potholes and, you know, trains, and I guess it's not so much snow removal, but ice removal there in Atlanta is really the big issue.
The big issue is everything from city services to filling potholes to getting that light fixed on your street corner to corruption within City Hall to huge issues like securing water rights for the city of Atlanta. A federal judge has said the state has 3 years to get congressional approval to take water from its current main water source, Lake Lanier, a federal reservoir. So whoever becomes mayor has got to clean up the city, this broken city by many perspectives from the top to the bottom.
Well, the takeaway there is the post-racial era in Atlanta may be boring, but it's still historic. Ricky Bevington, radio and TV news anchor for Georgia Public Broadcasting. Thanks so much, Ricky. Yeah. Good morning, John Hockenberry here. Celeste Headlee is home today, but thinking about all our hands around the Thanksgiving table on Thursday, how do you give thanks when your family might be giving you a bit of a headache? Some advice coming up. We're also talking to you about healthcare rationing because many people make tough choices about care to reject or to receive. Sometimes it's an issue of expense. Tell us your story.
I recently canceled my health insurance that I had through my employer because the premium just went up $100 a month for me. Last year it went up $80 a month. So over the last 2 years it's gone up almost $200 and I literally can't afford it anymore. So I'm 52 years old and uninsured.
Healthcare reform is going to depend on people having tough conversations with their doctors about care to avoid and care to receive. Tell us your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTake at thetakeaway.org. Right now, let's check on leading stories at 48 minutes after the hour with Femi Okeh.
Good morning. Senator Charles Schumer says that majority Democrats will push through a bill overhauling the healthcare system with or without Republican support. The New York Democrat accused GOP lawmakers of seeking to kill it and said, I'm going to quote him here, they haven't put any alternative on the floor, end of quote. Schumer appeared on NBC's Today Show in the wake of a key Senate vote Saturday that paved the way for debate on the measure. First-time buyers rushing to beat the clock on what they thought was an expiring tax credit are expected to have pushed October home sales up. Economists polled by Thomson Reuters say that they expect sales to show 1.4% increase. The tax credit, set to expire at the end of the month, has been extended to the spring. Abroad, and the Australian Prime Minister Kevin Rudd has become the latest senior politician to concede that a binding treaty on greenhouse gas emissions probably won't be reached at next week's Copenhagen summit. But Mr. Rudd said that a framework agreement could be reached and that could form the basis for a binding treaty later. And there's a look at some of the stories we're following this morning. John.
Finally, we go now to Brazil. Paulo Cabral is a reporter on Brazilian affairs for our partner, the BBC World Service. He's at the Foreign Ministry in the Brazilian capital, Brasilia, where Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad is set to arrive shortly to begin what's being called a bilateral dialogue between the Brazilian leader, President Lula, and President Ahmadinejad. Paulo Cabral, good morning.
Good morning, and President Ahmadinejad should arrive here at any minute. This visit to Brazil has sparked some controversy in the country. Mainly Brazilian Jewish groups, but also gay rights and human rights groups have protested against this visit and asking President Lula to explain to Mr. Ahmadinejad what freedom of expression means. This is what these protesters have been saying. President Lula, on his side, says he's honored to have Ahmadinejad in Brazil because he's the third important leader of the Middle East to visit the country in under 2 weeks. We had the visit of the president of Israel, Shimon Peres, last week, and before that, the president of the Palestinian Authority, Mahmoud Abbas, also was here. But critics of President Lula say that actually Iran is going to use this context in Latin America to sort of breach the international isolation to which the country has been submitted. So some cooperation agreements will be signed here today, but no specific commercial deals, which are made difficult actually by all the sanctions that Iran is under right now.
So Paulo Cabral, I guess I'm wondering, what is in this for Brazilian President Lula da Silva? The Brazilian government has said that it wants to be energy independent regarding ethanol fuel. The fact that it would make trade deals with Iran, I don't quite understand what is in it for the Brazilians, and specifically endorsing the Iranian nuclear program. It's puzzling.
Yeah, there is a number of reasons for this. One of them is that Brazil also wants to pursue a nuclear program, a Pacific nuclear program. I don't think anybody would think otherwise about Brazil. So there is, in a sense, this general principle of self-affirmation, which could be in Brazilian minds when discussing this issue of nuclear issues with Iran. But I'd say that one of the most important things is the effort that Brazil is making to be seen as a major global player. President Lula said he's going in March to the Middle East to talk about peace. And actually, even quite curious, President Lula says he wants to organize a soccer match between Israeli and Palestinian players in Brazil. So this ends up all being part of this effort of Brazil to have more importance as an international player. The same kind of importance that Brazil is acquiring economically in the world, there is a search for this importance to be reflected also in political terms.
Well, an interesting and possibly symbolic showcase there in Brazil as the Brazilian leader awaits a visit by Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. De Paula Cabral is a reporter on Brazilian affairs for our partner, the BBC World Service in Brasilia. Good morning. Our family segment anticipates Thanksgiving, that most family-friendly of holidays, we think. Kate Daly joins us, health and lifestyle editor for Newsweek.com in the studio. Good morning, Kate.
Good morning.
And also Rochelle Riley, friend of The Takeaway and columnist for the Detroit Free Press, joins us from Detroit. Rochelle, good morning.
Good morning.
So, Kate and Rochelle, I'm sure this is an experience that you're familiar with, that people come home from various places in the country. They sit around the table. There's enormous pressure to get along, but often it's kind of difficult to prevent subjects and discussions from getting out of hand. Rochelle, first of all, the worst case scenarios in your experience.
Well, actually, I've never had that experience. I grew up in an African-American family and a Southern family, and Thanksgiving, particularly at the dinner table, is never where that type of conversation happens.
Is there pressure on families to maybe make nice on holidays like Thanksgiving when we don't spend as much time with each other as maybe we might in days of yore?
Absolutely. I think that Thanksgiving is the art of prevention between making sure that you seat people, the right people next to the right people. You make sure that you focus on food, and anybody who you think might have something to say sits at the kiddie table. So, no, there are no serious conversations that could make you miss my grandmother's oyster dressing.
That's fantastic. How do you enforce sitting at the kiddie table if you might say something that no one wants to hear?
Well, typically that person is the last person in line to get the buffet-style dinner, and then by the time you get back to the living room where all the tables are lined up in a row for one long banquet table, your seat is not at that table, but with the kids.
That is brilliant. Rochelle Riley, columnist for the Detroit Free Press. Kate Daly, what are the pitfalls of families getting together and attempting to make it look like there aren't serious issues underneath the table?
Well, I mean, you can't choose your family. So who you have is who you're stuck with. And a lot of times, like, I'm from a big Northeastern Irish Catholic family. And so we've got a lot of different brothers and sisters, aunt and uncles, a lot of whom have grown up to have different perspectives. And especially right now, like at this time in American history, there's a lot going on in the headlines where it's almost impossible not to have politics come up at the dinner table. And what happens is, when you talk about politics, different than arguing perhaps about a sports team or about something in pop culture, people really feel so personally invested that it can get out of hand because they might feel like their way of life or their livelihood is actually being threatened, which is not what you want to have when you sit down and have a couple drinks with your family.
Or stuff gets dredged up from the past. I mean, I have to say, I've lived all over the world, and I've spent lots of Thanksgivings with lots of different kinds of families. I have to say that culturally, families really differ in their ability to handle this kind of Thanksgiving dinner piece. Is that your experience, Kate?
Absolutely. And I think that there are some families who really enjoy having a really spirited discussion, and there are some families who would be horrified. I have a friend whose brother brought a girl home for Thanksgiving, and he later found her just sobbing in the bathroom. And he said, what happened? What did we do wrong? And she said, you guys are all fighting, and I can't understand it. I thought we were having such a good time. And he said, no, we're Cuban. That's just what we do. That's how we talk. And, you know, she was from a town in Connecticut and was really couldn't handle the raised voices. So if you're going to someone else's house for Thanksgiving, it's important to ask them ahead of time how they talk about the issues of the day, if there are any subjects that are forbidden or off limits, and just have an understanding that some people really enjoy getting into these spirited debates while other people find it untenable.
It sounds like everyone pitching in to prepare the meal is pretty helpful in your neck of the woods, Rochelle.
It is absolutely the best part of Thanksgiving. You do want to sit down and eat the food, but the time in the kitchen where everyone is doing something, and you can have real serious conversations because you know that there will be a moment coming where it won't be so bad.
So the advice, Kate Daly, is to arrive early enough to be involved in the chopping.
Right, and I would also have some dodges prepared. So if they want to talk about health care, you can have a story about the woman who was on Oprah and had her face ripped off by the chimp. If they want to talk about gay rights, you can talk about Adam Lambert and Taylor Swift at the AMAs. And if all else fails, you can bring up Balloon Boy.
Balloon Boy, I will say, as Rochelle Riley, columnist for the Detroit Free Press. Also, Kate Daly, health and lifestyle editor for Newsweek.com. Thanks to you both. Have a great Thanksgiving, and share your Thanksgiving family stories with us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytakeatthetakeaway.org. Also, we're talking about health care reform and the question of rationing tough choices on expense and elsewhere. 877-8-MY-TAKE. Celeste Headlee is out for the day. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway. The wheels of democracy turned all weekend, and the Senate produced a 60-vote majority and a Democratic health care reform bill.
Don't be so gloomy. After all, it's not that awful. In Italy, for 30 years under the Borgias, they had warfare, terror, murder, and bloodshed, but they produced Michelangelo, Leonardo da Vinci, and the Renaissance. In Switzerland, they had brotherly love. They had 500 years of democracy and peace, and what did that produce? The cuckoo clock. So long, Holly.
The 60-vote majority, has it given us a Michelangelo or a cuckoo clock? In the first test of its lawmaking ability, the Democratic majority holds, for now. The Borgias and the Democrats on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning, everyone. This is The Takeaway. Also on the program, we've got a discussion of money and executives who do not sink when their actual companies sink. And, of course, my brain is, like, completely off this morning. But let's talk about that 60-vote majority. What has it given us? Theda Skocpol joins us, political scientist at Harvard University. Good morning, Professor. You know, we talked there about the democracy and the Senate. How good do you think the machinery of lawmaking in Washington is? I mean, this is a real landmark bill, and it seems the House and the Senate haven't given up anything this ambitious in almost a generation.
Well, you're right. You could even argue 40, 50 years. The House haggles and decides. The Senate, you know, 100 preening peacocks, and in the end, about two or three of them representing less than 5% of the population decide whether you even get to debate the most important social legislation in a generation.
So, Theda, what does it mean if Democrats holding the White House, the House, and the Senate can't make significant change?
Oh, boy, you know, this is the moment of truth for the Democrats. They campaigned on change. They've got huge majorities. If they can't do it, they're finished.
Theda Skocpol joins us, political scientist at Harvard University. She'll be back to talk more about the lawmaking machinery in the Senate. But first, everything else you need to know this morning. Democrats are saying that they will push through the health care bill with or without Republican support. Senator Charles Schumer was on the Today Show this morning.
We asked them to put an alternative on the floor so we could debate it. The Republican Party has just said no, no, no.
What do the Republicans say?
We are in a jobless situation in our country, an economic crisis. You are going to put taxes and mandates on business that are going to make that situation even worse.
That's Republican Senator Kay Bailey Hutchison on the Today Show outlining the Republicans' concern. Floor debate starts next week in the Senate. It's been a deadly 24 hours for U.S. soldiers in Afghanistan. NATO is reporting three American servicemen killed in bombings. A fourth died in a firefight. The professed mastermind of the 9/11 attacks and his four accused accomplices will plead not guilty in a New York civilian courtroom. Their lawyer says the accused terrorists will use their trial to air criticisms of the United States. The lawyer for Major Nidal Malik Hassan says the suspected Fort Hood shooter is now paralyzed from the waist down. Doctors believe the paralysis is permanent from a bullet he took during the shooting. A new survey considers that the job market may start loosening up next year. The National Association for Business Economics expects employers to start hiring more in the second quarter of 2010. Until then, they expect consumers to keep a pretty tight rein on their budgets. The Dow opens at a tick above 10,300 later on this hour. Futures are up. The S&P will open a shade under 1,100, and the Nasdaq opens at 2,146. And as we said, futures are up, so a rally is expected when Wall Street gets underway about a half hour from now. Rationing is a word that comes up in the media on healthcare. What's your story?
My name is Tonil Tomlin. I once paid cash to see a hepatologist when I was self-employed and I didn't have health care. This was only about $200, and I got all the necessary lab work and tests that I needed. I think more people should be responsible for their own health care. I think it's unrealistic to ask small businesses to provide health care to their employees.
Have you rationed care for you, your family, or your employees? Tell us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. More about health care and the lawmaking machinery there on Capitol Hill in just a moment. Good morning, everyone. Well, the Senate Democrats had their 60 votes to start debate, and now there will be weeks and weeks of debate and amendments on the health care reform bill. The procedural vote started the debate, and it took place on Saturday night. How long will the debate go on? Well, we have with us Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent, and Theda Skocpol, who's the professor of government and sociology at Harvard University. We were talking to there at the top of the hour. Todd, do you think that the Democrats are going to have 60 votes to end debate when the time comes for that?
John, we got to see around a lot of corners to know that. There's really no way to know right now except that the Democrats have such a huge political premium on getting this done that it's hard to, you don't want to imagine a scenario for their own political prospects anyway where they wouldn't put together a compromise that'll get this bill off the floor. And just to refresh memories real quickly, you have Joe Lieberman, Ben Nelson, Mary Landrieu, and Blanche Lincoln, all of whom have said in one form or another, for one reason or another, that they will not vote at the end of this debate the way they voted on Saturday night. That means a lot of compromise and a lot of amendments. I spoke to Ben Nelson, the conservative Democrat from Nebraska, who's been at the center of this as he was coming off the floor on Saturday night in the Senate. And I asked him, is this just a question of nuance, getting this bill off the floor, or do you need to see significant changes? He said, I've submitted a list of changes in principle to Harry Reid that I need to see before I can vote for this. Nuance is not enough. I need to see major systemic changes in this bill.
The Nelson ultimatum there. It sounds like...
And he's not the only one.
Right, exactly. So there's ultimatums all over the place.
Yeah.
Theda Skocpol, you know, people who are students of Congress in the last couple of administrations might conclude that, there was no child left behind. That was a Bush administration initiative that was significant legislatively, although it was an unfunded mandate, essentially, or say the passage of prescription drug reform on Medicare. But of course, that's a program that already existed. How would you distinguish this program from and the ambition of this legislation from others in the recent past?
Oh, I mean, this is the most ambitious we've seen since the attempt to do a similar remake of the regulatory and financial structure in healthcare in 1993-94. You know, this is what, a sixth or seventh of the U.S. economy that we're talking about, a complex set of public and private programs covering people and improving the insurance for all those who already have it, changing the incentives in the profit-making system and the healthcare delivery system. It's hugely ambitious.
Has the House and Senate worked as they were intended to work in fashioning this legislation based on your read of the Constitution and history?
Well, intend. I mean, I can't imagine that the founding fathers ever imagined Joe Lieberman. I mean, it's definitely the case that they designed a Senate to represent states, which means not population, the founders, and to cool down initiatives that might get going in the House. But we have Senate rules now interacting with a fanatically determined minority that really is slowing down decisions even to decide for months at a time. I don't think that was quite envisaged.
The 60-vote issue was the ghost that haunted even the committee deliberations on this bill. Todd Zwillick, has the committee structure worked as well as it was expected? And compare this to, say, civil rights legislation back in the 60s.
Yeah, the committees have actually worked fairly well in this case. Five committees, you know, of jurisdiction reporting out means making a bill and voting it out of committee. Five committees of jurisdiction did it, and the leadership on both the House and the Senate side stitched them into bills that have gotten to the floor. So that process has worked fairly well. You know, I hear Theda talking about how the founding fathers never envisioned a Joe Lieberman, you know, and getting 60 votes to even start talking. You know, it's interesting, John, because this, what we've seen in the last several months and the machinations just to get to 60 votes to get this on the floor, that's nothing. It's nothing. You know, the filibuster rule used to be 67. not 60. It used to be even harder to get a bill on the floor. Actually, the Senate majority has it much easier now than they did before the 1940s. And, you know, looking at civil rights, as you mentioned, you know, Congress passed some civil rights measures after the Civil War and Reconstruction. But from 1938, you know, in 1938, there were lots of anti-lynching bills that were introduced and passed in the House. And in the post-war period, when it became clear that African-American soldiers had, you know, fought and died in Europe and Asia, people started to realize that it was unfair to have segregation and anti-voting laws and anti-voting culture in the South. I didn't know this, but doing some research, you know, civil rights legislation passed in the House in 1946, 47, 48, and 1949, and 1950, only to be dashed against the Senate, which refused to pass it because of the power of the Southern filibuster. And it wasn't until 1957, of course, after the famous filibuster from Strom Thurmond, that they passed any civil rights legislation, which was very weak. And then not until 1965, when Lyndon Johnson was president, that civil rights legislation had any teeth. So this healthcare debate is only a small, tiny version of what the country and what the Senate and House went through to get civil rights.
Theda Scotchpole, do you think that the Senate is doing its traditional role, holding back significant change until the last minute, warily eyeing legislation like this?
I think it's true that civil rights legislation and anything to do with the place of African Americans in the legal system or the voting system was more clogged up from before the Civil War through the 1960s than anything we see in healthcare or social policy. But we need to keep in mind that over the last 20 years, the use of the 60-vote standard to prevent things from moving to get forward at all has been taken to a post-war, post-World War II extreme by conservative Republicans. This is really a movement interacting with the rules of the Senate. And remember, when the Republicans had their majorities under George W. Bush, Jr., they successfully pushed back informally against the Democrats and kept them from invoking the same kinds of frequent votes.
These dynamics complicate and assist in the package of health care reform. That's Theda Scotchpole, professor of government and sociology at Harvard University, and Todd Zwillick, surprising me there, Takeaway Washington correspondent. And at 14 minutes after the hour, let's get a look at some headlines we're following this morning. Femi?
Thank you very much. Now, as we have been discussing, battle lines are being drawn in the latest round of healthcare debate. That's after Senate Democrats united this weekend to advance the legislation to the Senate floor. The issue of a public option remained a sticking point, but Democratic Senator Charles Schumer, speaking on NBC this morning, says there is real momentum in his party to get a bill to the president.
I think every one of the 60 Democratic senators, you can even tell it in the tone of some of the remarks, wants to have a bill. We all know we're going to have to give a little.
But Republican Senator Kay Bailey Hutchison, also speaking on NBC this morning, said that there was little to commend the Senate offering.
The government takeover at a cost of $2.5 trillion over the 10 years starting in 2014 is going to add to our debt, it's going to add to costs, and it is going to take away the choices that people have in health care.
That was Senator Kay Bailey Hutchison of Texas. Now, in other news, four Americans died in Afghanistan over the weekend, three in the south and another in the east of the country. The Indian Prime Minister Manmohan Singh is in the United States for talks with President Obama. Before he left for Washington, Mr. Singh addressed the situation in Afghanistan, saying it would be a catastrophe for much of Asia if the Taliban was victorious. And it's not yet clear when 150 workers from the Three Mile Island nuclear plant in Pennsylvania will return to work. There was some low-level contamination over the weekend. And finally, the Twilight saga, New Moon, had the third biggest opening weekend of all time, pulling in $140 million here in the US and another $120 million overseas. That's a look at your news for now.
Hey, you want that to go?
positively a line at the takeout window this morning in the Takeaway studio. Always stories we want you to stay on top of in this segment. Femi Oke is here, Ibrahim Abdelmateen with sports, and Louise Story, finance reporter for our partners, The New York Times, all in the studio.
Good morning.
Oh, it's a crowd. It's a crowd. It's crowdsourcing. So, Louise, let's begin with you. The demise of Bear Stearns and Lehman Brothers, of course, caused a chain reaction in the financial sector. Mm-hmm. And among the consequences, of course, was the destruction of all kinds of jobs in the financial sector.
Yes.
All of a sudden, looking back, we learned that some of those executives did pretty well in the darkest days of Lehman Brothers and Bear Stearns. First of all, what did we learn and what does it mean?
So we've been hearing for a long time about all the money that these executives lost because, you know, a lot of them owned stock.
Sure.
And the CEO of both Lehman and the CEO of Bear Stearns each lost more than $900 million in paper value in their stock. So we've been hearing that. But what's new is today there's a study coming out from Harvard Law School that shows just how much they cashed out before these companies tumbled. And for the top five executives at Bear Stearns, it's $1.4 billion. For the top five executives at Lehman Brothers, it's more than $1 billion.
So company sinks, executives swim. And, I mean, certainly having $100 million in the bank, even if
right.
you used to be a billionaire, is probably okay.
It changes the equation. You know, they did have a lot of stock at risk at the end, but they had cashed out a lot. And when you're that wealthy and when you can cash out ahead, it does change the equation. Now, one thing in their defense is that some of these sales were for tax purposes. So when your stock vests, even if you hold some of it, you have to pay taxes on it. So some of these executives were paying some taxes with this. Nonetheless, they didn't lose their shirts here. They do have a substantial wealth. And this raises questions about, in the broader compensation debate, we've had some people saying, well, look, Lehman and Bear Stearns executives lost so much money in the stock, so that didn't work. But this study is pointing out that they also made quite a lot of money in the stock.
And the takeaway there is that as we talk about risk assessment,
yes.
a lot of these companies have within their books compensation arrangements
that could
are essentially
risk.
No risk. No risk,
right.
even if the company goes away.
They still make money.
Louise Story, thanks so much. Ibrahim Abdelmateen, the sports story this morning is it's looking a little bit like a Lance Armstrong situation in NASCAR. Jimmie Johnson, four-time champion of NASCAR.
So all he had to do yesterday was place 25th out of 30, but he took 5th. And with that, Jimmie Johnson chased himself into history. It was the NASCAR Sprint Cup. He would become the NASCAR Sprint Cup champion for a record-setting 4 years in a row. And you're right, you're perfectly right, that he joined the ranks of Lance Armstrong, who won the Tour de France for 7 years. Also, Pete Sampras won Wimbledon for 4 years in a row. The Celtics of the 60s won 11 championships out of 13 years. That's the kind of record that Jimmie Johnson made this week.
And NASCAR, of course, has huge audience numbers both on television and certainly in the arenas where NASCAR races are run.
And that's interesting. Compared to followers of NASCAR are familiar with names like Dale Earnhardt, Richard
right.
Petty.
Sure.
Those guys have both won 7 stock car championships. Neither of them have ever done what Jimmie Johnson did. And fans yesterday, all season long, were cheering against Jimmie, anyone but Jimmie. But at the end, they gave a standing ovation for Jimmie Johnson,
everybody.
Who doused himself in Gatorade instead of beer and champagne.
And everybody loves a winner, ultimately, there in NASCAR. You know, we had a discussion with Stephen Dubner of Super Freakonomics last week about issues in NASCAR race cars, that as they increase the number of safety components, it makes the drivers more reckless. And we also had a similar issue in the NFL, where if you wear a helmet in the NFL, it maybe encourages players to be a little more reckless, and thereby the number of injuries increases. We got this interesting response from one of our listeners. I want you to hear it, Ibrahim.
Hey, Celeste. Hey, John. This is Ethan in Brooklyn. I just wanted to say on this issue of concussions, I think it was the Malcolm Gladwell article in The New Yorker a couple of weeks ago that mentioned that, in fact, it's the problem of getting hit in the head a few hundred times in practice and in every game for 10 years and then 20 years. That's the big deal. It's not really specifically one or two concussions. Now I'm going to go bang my head against the wall.
The listener makes a serious point. The whole career of being, maybe a lineman in the NFL is about getting your head bashed.
I would say, like, when people ask me about my playing career, which was short, but it was 13 years of hitting people every single day. That's what I describe it as. Every day my job was to hit people head on for 5 days a week. And that takes a toll on you. I've had you know, I won't say how many, but I've had more than five concussions myself.
Wow.
And I think that every football player has gone through a moment where they've been hit and they don't know where they were for a second.
Ibrahim Abdelmateen, Takeaway sports contributor, played football in high school and college. And Louise Story, finance reporter for our partners in New York Times. Thanks to you both. And Femi Okeh is here for the last takeout, which comes from listeners who had some reaction to that talk show host announcing her goodbye last week.
Okay.
These years with you, our viewers, have enriched my life beyond all measure.
In more than ways than one, Oprah Winfrey announced she'll enter talk show in 2011. And we turn to you. What do you think of when you think of Oprah?
My most vivid image of Oprah is her ardent support for Barack Obama during the primary season. I think that she had a lot to do with winning over many white women.
That's Jay from Brooklyn, and Sarah emails, I don't feel good about her ability to judge, for example, during the James Fry situation, where he wrote a fabricated memoir and Oprah called him on it. You have too much power if you can make the world turn against a person that they've never met.
Cassie has this story. To me, Oprah is a call to action on behalf of others. A few years ago, I was recovering from surgery at home. I saw an episode of the show on the tragic lives of children in Darfur. I knew I could do little to help the suffering children in Africa, but I could help a child in my own state. And a year later, my husband and I adopted two brothers who had been in foster care for 7 years.
That's amazing. And Oprah's got a couple of schools in South Africa. Finally, over the weekend, the Twilight saga New Moon rose to the top of the box office. We talked last Friday with New York Times' film reviewer A.O. Scott about the movie and a book the series is based on. Now, he thought the books were actually terrible, written in a language that sometimes resembles English. He wasn't a big fan. But
the box office told the tale, right? New Moon sold a supernatural $140.7 million in movie tickets over the weekend in North American theaters alone. Third best opening. Take that, A.O. Scott.
Exceptional.
Yes. Tell us your take on anything on the program, 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTake at thetakeaway.org. Another look at the healthcare debate coming up. Immigrants.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Coming up, exclusion or coverage for illegal immigrants in any of the health care bills facing Congress. We'll take a look. Right now, let's check in on top news stories at 30 minutes past the hour. Femi Okeh is here.
Thanks, John. It's been a deadly 24 hours for U.S. soldiers in Afghanistan. NATO is reporting three American servicemen were killed in bombings, while a fourth died in a firefight. The health care battle is underway in the Senate. Democrats say that they're going to push through reforms with or without the Republicans. The main sticking points continue to be the so-called public option and the final price tag. Still, Democratic Senator Jack Reed says,
despite all of the ups and downs in this process, despite all of the fabrications and fears being spread, we have a darn good bill here.
But Senator Lamar Alexander sums up the Republican response.
It's the same turkey you didn't like in August, and it's not going to taste any better on Thanksgiving.
The floor debate begins after the holidays next week. The third and final spacewalk by the crew of the space shuttle Atlantis is underway right now. It was delayed by a minor problem earlier when a valve came off the spacesuit of astronaut Robert Satcher just as he was about to step out. The crew reattached the valve, and to everyone's relief, it stuck right back on. I have a date with NASA TV. I'll see you later, John. That's a look at the stories we're following this morning.
Thank you, Femi. So, as we've been mentioning all morning, the health care reform bill survived a procedural vote in the Senate. Debate begins in the greatest debating society on earth, the U.S. Senate. And among the debates will be questions of abortion and other passionate questions that arouse lots of emotions and may or may not have directly to do with health care reform. Immigration is one of those. And immigration reform and the service for illegal, undocumented immigrants in the United States has certainly been one of the key passionate issues that has dominated health care reform, both in the House and in the Senate. Kevin Sack joins us now, New York Times national correspondent. He covers health care. Kevin, good morning.
Hi, John. Thanks for having me.
It's certainly not news that nativist kinds of concerns about immigrants, the loose border, the fact that people from over there are coming into the United States is an issue in American politics. That's not new. But how has it affected this particular bill and this particular debate?
Well, I think the Democrats have been determined to try to minimize it as an issue as much as possible. They do not want the health care bill to turn into an immigration bill, and they certainly don't want the health care debate to turn into an immigration debate. It would doom it before it got started. So what they've done is made sure that in both the House and the Senate versions of the bill, there are explicit prohibitions against illegal immigrants receiving any direct benefits. In other words, they would continue to be ineligible for Medicare, the federal insurance program for the elderly and disabled. They would continue to be ineligible for Medicaid, the program for the poor, except in some very narrow circumstances where states make emergency Medicaid available to illegal immigrants. But they have not been able to avoid a lesser controversy over whether or not illegal immigrants would be allowed to buy health insurance on these new exchanges or virtual marketplaces that would be created. And there is a difference in the House legislation and the Senate legislation on that matter. The House would allow them to buy insurance on these exchanges, and the Senate would not. So that's something that's going to have to be hashed out in conference, and I'm sure it's an issue that we'll be hearing a lot about over the next few weeks.
And we're already seeing, and a story that you wrote for the Times that was published over the weekend suggests that medical institutions, hospitals, et cetera, are already taking matters into their own hands to restrict the offering of services to undocumented immigrants. Explain what you discovered in Atlanta.
Well, Grady Memorial Hospital in Atlanta is the big 117-year-old public hospital here where I'm based. It's supported directly by taxpayer appropriations from two counties. And like all public hospitals, its policy has basically been to accept all comers, regardless of immigration status. We all know that that immigrants have to be treated in emergency rooms of any hospital if they present themselves, regardless of their immigration status, if they arrive with an emergent condition. But what Grady and other public hospitals have been doing over the years is providing ongoing care. And in the case of Grady, they've been providing dialysis to about 90 patients on an ongoing basis. About two-thirds of them, perhaps, are illegal immigrants because they've got nowhere else to go for what's obviously a life-sustaining treatment. And back in July, Grady's board voted to shut this dialysis center down for financial reasons. It's a big money loser because most of the patients are illegal and therefore uninsurable for the most part. At least these patients are uninsurable. They can't afford private coverage anywhere. They can't get public coverage.
Well, one of those patients is 23-year-old dialysis patient Ignacio Lopez, who also joins us from Atlanta. Good morning, Ignacio.
Good morning.
When you were told that Grady Hospital would no longer allow you to seek dialysis treatment, where did you go?
They sent us to a private clinic for 3 months, and starting January, the 3 months are going to finish.
And if you don't receive dialysis in 1 or 2 weeks, what's the consequence for you?
Death. Uh-huh.
So Kevin Sack, Ignacio, who appears in your story, Ignacio Lopez, is one of the sort of ghosts haunting this healthcare debate in that as services are shut down, it's really almost random as to where they end up, right?
Right. Well, what's happened in the case of Grady and Ignacio, as he explained, is at the last minute after shutting down, announcing it was shutting down the clinic, Grady, in response to a lawsuit that's been filed by some of the patients, voluntarily agreed to provide 3 months of private dialysis at a private clinic to these patients while they try to make other arrangements. And Grady has agreed to help them either return to their home countries, they'll pay for airfare and they'll pay for 3 months of dialysis in those home countries, or perhaps go to another state where Medicaid policies might be more generous than they are in Georgia. But for the most part, these folks really don't have other options. Returning to their home countries is not really an option for some of them. They have no support system, no financial support there, no family support there. And so they're left waiting, and many of them really feel that the clock is ticking, as Ignacio said, down towards this January 3rd date when their 3 months runs out.
Well, Ignacio, if you could afford insurance, would you buy it?
Yeah.
What's the chance of that being a possibility for you?
It's not a big chance, but well, we try to do like donations and sell T-shirts for we can buy insurance for everybody. It's one of the options we've been trying.
Well, Ignacio, good luck to you. We want to check in with you before January, if possible. Ignacio, please try to get your dialysis if you can. Kevin Sack, a final word? I mean, this really sort of sets the stark reality of this debate.
It's a real microcosm of what's going on nationally. And again, the big debate in Washington is going to be over these exchanges. The argument against allowing them in is sort of a symbolic one. It's, what type of public resources should be expended to benefit folks illegally?
Looming above the debate is the question, what happens to people like Ignacio? Kevin Sack, New York Times national correspondent. He covers healthcare. Also, Ignacio Lopez, dialysis patient, awaiting a deadline in January. So coming up, we're kicking off a week-long series on faith in America. What does being pro-life mean to you? For some, it's not just about abortion. We talk about the terms and language of faith later this hour. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. A fish story now. Ken DeBozard, director of the Office of the Great Lakes for the state of Michigan. Good morning, sir.
Good morning.
So I'm out on a boat, right? I'm out on one of the Great Lakes. I'm fishing for steelhead, right? And I hook into something really huge, right? And I'm starting to reel it in. And about a foot from the surface, I realize I've got a big carp. How depressed am I?
Well, let's hope it's just a bad dream. And we're hoping that we can still take actions to prevent that from occurring. But the fear of Asian carp entering the Great Lakes is something that has become more real based on testing that became known last week.
And explain exactly what the tests showed and what's the difference between an Asian carp from any other kind of fish as far as Great Lakes sports fishermen and others in the ecosystem are concerned.
Well, last week there was some new DNA testing that was conducted that showed that there was the presence, at least DNA evidence, of the carp past the point that we had expected and past the point of an electrical barrier that was installed, a $9 million barrier that was put in place to prevent the carp from actually getting through the sanitary ship canal in Chicago into the Great Lakes.
And Ken, this is like an electric fence underwater, right?
That's the right. It's been put in place. There's one array that's in place now, and we had plans to put some additional protections in place there. This new evidence indicates that in some way that this DNA evidence is past that point of that barrier. And the carp are considerably of concern because, as they have demonstrated throughout the Mississippi system where they have entered and have moved their way north, they tend to outcompete the native fisheries and largely dominate those areas where they have come into contact. And so our Great Lakes fishery, a $4.5 billion fishery, is at risk.
Well, Ken, listen to this, will you, and tell me what's going on here. This is some sound that we got from the Illinois River. Listen to this and see if you can identify what's going on here.
Dear Lord.
Now, well, I'm afraid it sounds like the sound of the flying variety of species of the Asian carp. The carp can grow up to 4 feet in length and up to 100 pounds, but some of the species are smaller, and when startled by noise like the engine noise of the boats that I think we just heard, can fly up to 6-7 feet in the air and have created some human impacts as well, creating some threats to the public safety from boaters.
I mean, I'm thinking I'm like a bass or something, smallmouth bass down in the water in the Great Lakes, and I'm looking at these flying Asian carp, and I'm going, man, I don't have a chance here.
Well, it is an unfortunate fact that in areas where they have come through the Mississippi that they have crowded out all the other native fisheries. In fact, they can consume their body weight on a daily basis. They were brought in the South to inland ponds to consume the algae. Did a good job of that, but unfortunately, when flooding occurred, they entered the Mississippi and have worked their way north. So this human introduction, one of the many ways that we have seen up to the 180 invasive species that have entered the Great Lakes from a variety of vectors.
And Ken DeBozard is the head of the Office of the Great Lakes for Michigan and is leading the fight to contain and eliminate the non-native carp, the Asian species. Ken, thanks so much.
Thank you for your interest.
Coming up, our faith-based series in honor of Thanksgiving week begins. We're going to talk with two people who suggest there is a generational shift going on among evangelicals. Good mid-morning. I'm John Hockenberry. Celeste Headlee is out for today. Coming up, language and the faithful. There's a generational split among evangelicals regarding what it means. Terms like pro-life don't mean what they used to mean. Right now, we have Femi Okeh here with a check on some leading stories at 48 minutes after the hour. Good morning, Femi.
Good morning, everybody. Now, it's not yet clear when 150 workers from the Three Mile Island nuclear plant in Pennsylvania will return to work. There was some low-level contamination over the weekend. Investigators continue to look into how the radiation leak happened. A leading Senate Democrat says that his party will push through a healthcare overhaul bill because, in his words, the current system is broken. New York Senator Charles Schumer told NBC this morning his party would prefer to have Republicans on board. But appearing on the same show, Republican Senator Kay Bailey Hutchinson called the bill, I'm going to quote her here, a terrible idea, end of quote. Economists are predicting home sales for October to hit their highest level in more than 2 years. That's as first-time buyers scramble to take advantage of what they believe was an expiring tax credit. The tax credit was set to run out at the end of November, but has been renewed. Buyers now need to sign a purchase agreement by April the 30th next year. Former Alaska Governor Sarah Palin is visiting Fort Bragg in North Carolina today. She'll be signing her copies of her new book. And finally, you're watching a music awards ceremony and then a little saucy something, or could it be a somebody, comes on stage to wake you up. Oh, do you know what you got into? Can you handle what I'm about to That's do? American Idol contestant Adam Lambert singing For Your Entertainment in a memorably lascivious performance at the American Music Awards. Check the internet to see exactly what I mean by lascivious. An ABC Dick
Thank
Clark
you,
production.
Help me get through the day.
That's right, a little clue. The top award for Artist of the Year actually went to Taylor Swift, who beat out Michael Jackson.
To even be mentioned in a category with Michael Jackson, who we will miss and love forever, is an unimaginable honor.
Now, Taylor Swift won four other awards, including Best Album last night.
And Kanye West was found outside in the alley whacking himself with a hammer on the head, I think.
I'm glad you finished that sentence. Yep. Michael Jackson won four posthumous awards, including Favorite Musical Artist. And those are some of the stories we're watching this morning.
One nation under God, indivisible.
Specific divine being.
Religious discrimination.
Rediscovering God in America.
I truly do believe it's a miracle.
One nation under God.
Power of faith.
As we approach Thanksgiving, the holiday season basically begins. Christmas and Hanukkah are around the corner. Advent begins around this time. The Hajj is beginning this Wednesday in Mecca. We wanted to take a look at faith in America. And we begin by talking about the language of faith and a generational split that seems to be taking place among evangelicals, for whom, for much of my political life, questions of abortion and the death penalty were seemingly settled for them and for their congregations. Jay Baker joins us. He's the son of Jim and Tammy Faye Baker, pastor and co-founder of the Pro-Gay Inclusive Revolution Church in Brooklyn, New York. He's here in the studio. Jay Baker, good morning.
Good morning.
And Joel Hunter joins us. He's a senior pastor at the Northland Church in Longwood, Florida. He's a faith advisor to Barack Obama, even though he's a Republican and a self-proclaimed conservative. Joel, good morning.
Hey, how are you?
First of all, let's talk about a generational split among evangelicals. What does that mean, and how is that reflected in your work? Joel?
Basically, what you see is going from a very narrow agenda of conservative Christians that identified way too much with the issues of the Republican Party and focused on only issues like abortion and gay marriage, and always had a sense that they were being attacked for something, to this next generation that has a much broader agenda and sees pro-life in terms of other issues like poverty and immigration and what makes for a stronger life in all of life instead of just narrowing it down on a few personal, especially sexual, moral issues.
All right, Joel Hunter. Well, let's listen to what perhaps you are describing as the traditional view of some of these so-called family issues.
God hates the sin of sodomy.
We don't have to debate about what we should think about homosexual activity. It's written in the Bible.
Abortion is murder, plain and simple.
There are those who say, how can you be pro-life and believe in a death penalty?
God is not pro-choice.
I believe there is a place for a death penalty.
So Mike Huckabee, Ted Haggard, and other voices there speaking what seem to be settled questions for those evangelicals. Jay Baker, when young people who would describe themselves as evangelicals hear that kind of talk, in your experience, what's the reaction?
Well, I think it's kind of a turnoff in some ways, because I think this younger generation is really focused on loving the hurting and the poor and not ostracizing folks. And a lot of that language has been buzz language. And I think, you know, when you study the Word and you look deeper into the Word, you realize that Jesus did more with the poor and the hurting than didn't even talk about most of the subjects that a lot of evangelicals are focused on or were focused on.
How is that reflected particularly, Jay, in your pastoral work? And how difficult was it for you, even if you did, break from your own family on these questions?
Well, it differs for me because I'm a gay-affirming pastor. You know, I believe it's a civil rights issue. And when I took that stand, I lost a year's worth of speaking engagements, lost all of our church funding, had to let my whole staff go. So it's still definitely taboo in the evangelical church. I mean, it hasn't like just changed overnight, but things are changing.
Joel Hunter, the Republican Party has certainly, at least some in the Republican Party, have made a point, a strategic point, of associating themselves with the practicing faithful, with particularly the Christian identity. And I don't mean that in the sort of jingoistic term, but Christianity is a part of the identity of the Republican Party. Do you think the Republican Party needs Christianity more than Christianity needs the Republican Party, Joel Hunter?
Absolutely. First of all, Christianity should never be defined by any particular political party. It's much bigger than that, and has a much more has a much more higher reference point. And so, I think that heretofore Republicans have been very smart in trying to engage Christians, especially conservative Christians, on some of these issues. Democrats are becoming much more putting much more effort into building relationships with Christians, because a lot of Democrats are Christians. I mean,
right.
It's, God doesn't have a party, you know. So both parties should be trying to speak out on issues with a moral voice. And that's the right way it should go.
Jay Baker, in the Obama era, and thinking about your father and your late mother to a certain extent, are traditional evangelicals of the 70s and 80s cast adrift in this era, in your view?
Yeah, I think it's starting to happen. They're starting to definitely be adrift, and we're entering into a new day and age with a lot of churches being on the internet, and you know, just access to all sorts of information. So, yeah, I think times have changed.
But there are people, evangelicals, who would dispute what you and Joel are saying as a break from tradition and not part of the future.
Oh, definitely, definitely. There's definitely an age gap, but hopefully we can close that gap and get it a little bit closer.
Message for Thanksgiving, Joel Hunter, before we go, quickly.
Well, God is good, and all good gifts come from God, it says in Scripture. And so I think that all of us should concentrate on the wonderful things that he's given us so that we can solve our problems in the proper perspective.
Thank you, Joel and Jay.
just love each other.
Good advice. Jay Baker, son of Jim and Tammy Faye Baker, pastor and co-founder of the Inclusive Revolution Church in Brooklyn, New York. Joel Hunter is senior pastor of Northland Church in Longwood, Florida, and a faith advisor to Barack Obama. Tomorrow in our series of Faith in America, the rise of interfaith marriages and how it affects families. You can get the conversation started by telling us your story. If you're in one or had difficulty with a relationship because of differing faiths, tell us your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE. And you're also reaching out to tell us stories about rationing in your life, healthcare rationing. I'm a freelancer, Mari writes, who's gone in and out of insurance coverage. A few years ago, I found a suspicious-looking mole just 2 weeks before I lost my insurance and had to decide whether to have it checked. I had it checked. And it was cancer. I wouldn't have had insurance to pay for any of the big costs, and I've had a pre-existing condition, so I waited until I had insurance again. Fortunately, it turned out to be nothing, but it was a stressor for that year. You know how to reach us, 877-8-MY-TAKE. Celeste Headlee is out for the day. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway. You know, you can catch the show live Monday through Friday. Thanks for listening. If you have any feedback or think there's any stories we should be covering on The Takeaway, contact us at 1-877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. See ya.